cable sent to KGB headquarters from the New York Residentura nearly 5 years ago, in February 1944. He quickly scanned the words until he came to the sentence Meredith had underlined. He read aloud, "Rest arrived in the country." Bob stopped, and Meredith explained that "country" was Moscow Center's cover name for America. He continued reading. "As a member of the island..." Another pause, and once again Meredith dutifully filled in, "Island" was KGB speak for England. Then Bob went on to finish the sentence, "Mission to Enormos." There was no need to explain what Enormos stood for. Bob read the entire decrypted cable again. When he spoke, his words were directed to his friend, but he might just as well have been speaking to himself. "There's no longer any doubt that Rest was part of the British scientific delegation," he said. "None," Meredith agreed. At last, resigned to the distasteful task, Bob hurried back to headquarters, determined to find the traitor. In the hunt for a spy, the standard counterintelligence strategy is to pursue opportunity and motive. There were 15 names on Bob's list, and after just a glance he saw that the question of which of them had the opportunity to steal America's atomic secrets could be answered in a flash. Depressingly, they all did. Therefore, Bob decided he'd make better use of his time by concentrating on which of the scientists possessed a motive. Once again, he did some quick elimination. Money, sex, blackmail. None of these usual motivations for betrayal, Bob's instincts told him, were in play in this case. All his experiences on the SE desk suggested this was a political operation. The spy had gone to work for Moscow Center out of an allegiance to the Soviet cause. It was a crime driven by ideology, not passion or greed. Yet even as Bob took this investigative tack, he pursued it with a measure of distaste. He had been raised by a famously, at least in the mines and saloons of Mullen, contrarian father, a man who liked to lecture that people have a right to think and talk as suited them. That was what America was all about, Joe Lamphere was fond of saying. And Bob was his father's son. While there were many passionate cold warriors on the Bureau's fifth floor, including, he knew, the director, who could work themselves up into quite a lather about the Red Menace, Bob never could muster their knee-jerk outrage. Spying was one thing, but being "a little bit pink," as he'd put it, was another thing entirely. In fact, despite all the recent headlines Senator Joseph McCarthy had been making, Bob couldn't help feeling, and the instinct would, with hindsight, build over the years into an angry conviction, that McCarthy's approach and tactics hurt the anti-communist activities in the United States. Bob was totally committed to battling the KGB's operations in America, but at the same time he believed McCarthy's Star Chamber proceedings, his lies and overstatements, hurt our counterintelligence efforts. Tar and feathering people based on little more than contrivance and innuendo, that had no place in Bob's kind of patriotism. Still, when his burrowers now dug deeper, four names on the list came back to him with distinct ties to communist organizations. And Bob understood that this alignment of potential motive as well as certain opportunity made each of the four scientists a prime suspect. Each fit the profile of a sympathizer who had volunteered his services to Moscow Center, or had been targeted for recruitment. After a more intensive search, Bob quickly winnowed down his list. Two of the scientists, he discovered, had only a youthful infatuation with communism. He could find none of the incriminating signs. Party membership cards, presence at demonstrations, signatures on petitions, or finger-pointing reports from the legions of FBI informants who had pervasively infiltrated both the party and the aligned front organizations, that suggested any ongoing sympathy with Moscow. Perilously aware that the spy could still be actively working for the center, that Rest could be passing secrets about the ongoing manufacture of the hydrogen bomb, Bob decided to move forward. He concentrated his attention on the two names that remained. His first target was the leader of the British mission, Rudolf Peierls. After just scratching the surface, Bob was convinced he'd found gold. The scientist's biography could have served as a casebook history of a Soviet mole. A German émigré who had continued his studies in England, Peierls had met his wife, a Russian physicist, on a visit to Odessa. But what set off alarm bells clanging in Bob's mind was that following their marriage, in Leningrad in 1931, no obstacles had been placed on Eugenia Peierls' emigration or on her acquiring German citizenship. The spiteful Russians were rarely so accommodating in such circumstances, and certainly would have been even more resolute when the immigrant was an acclaimed physicist doing sensitive work. Why had they so complacently cut her loose? The answer to this question became even more perplexing when Bob probed her family tree. Her sister was a biologist, and her widowed mother had remarried a writer. This was the sort of intellectual family that Stalin would be more likely to ship off to Siberia than allow, seemingly without the slightest restrictions, to leave the motherland. Adding more kindling to Bob's fire of suspicion, Peierls' brother was an expert on electric condensers who had also married a Russian, a member of the Soviet trade delegation in Berlin. They were a family with such improbable biographies that Bob was convinced that their histories could only be a collection of cover stories written for long-term penetration agents working for Moscow Center. Confident he had found his man, Bob nevertheless went ahead and dutifully did his due diligence on the final suspect on his list. Klaus Fuchs, also known as Karl, was the K. Fuchs who had written the gaseous diffusion report that wound up on a desk in the Lubyanka. Fuchs had impressive academic credentials. He had studied under two of the high priests of theoretical physics, first in Leipzig with Werner Heisenberg, who had become a principal scientist on the Nazi nuclear weapon project, and then, after escaping to England, with Max Born at the University of Edinburgh. His family background seemed equally admirable. His father, a Lutheran pastor, had converted to Quakerism and held a chair in theology at the Educational Academy in Kiel. When the Gestapo targeted the Quakers, Fuchs, who had apparently inherited his father's pacifist streak, was one step ahead of the stormtroopers, escaping first to France and then making his way to England, where he was taken in by a Quaker family. After working with the British scientists in New York, he spent the next 2 years as part of the theoretical division team at the Los Alamos Laboratory. There was, Bob decided after making his way through the background file the AEC had provided, nothing here to raise suspicions. All his tracking through Fuchs's life, Bob was certain, had only served to eliminate him as a suspect. Besides, he already had his man. Rudolf Peierls was Rest. Or was he? For just as Bob decided he was ready to write his report for the fifth floor, his buddy Ernie Van Loon pulled him aside. Following up on Bob's order, Van Loon had been digging through the Bureau's own files, and he had found not one but two items that he felt the man running the show had to see, at once. The first was a Gestapo document, part of the Nazi records trove the Allies had gotten their hands on after the war, and which military intelligence had recently passed on to the FBI. This file identified Klaus Fuchs not as a Quaker, but as a militant communist who had been fighting the brown shirts in the streets of Kiel. There were orders for his arrest on sight. Bob read the document, but he was not yet willing to accept it. Instead, he tried to persuade himself that Klaus Fuchs was a common name. How many young men must have shared that name in Kiel, he wondered. It was a good-sized city, after all. So Van Loon offered up his second find, an address book. After the defection of Igor Gozenko, the Soviet embassy cipher clerk, the Canadian authorities had used the leads he'd provided to round up Russian agents. In the apartment of Israel Halperin, a mathematician who was also an agent of the GRU, the Russian Military Intelligence Organization, they found an address book with Fuchs's name. It seemed a stretch, Van Loon pointedly argued, that a Soviet agent who had been poking around the Canadian uranium production facility would be in touch with a Los Alamos scientist simply to talk about the weather. But Bob remained unconvinced. Enormous was a KGB operation. In his experience, there was about as much crossover between the GRU and the KGB as, well, between the FBI and the CIA. Before Van Loon started treating this thin evidence as counts in an indictment, a lot more had to be established. Stubbornly, Bob held on to his belief that Pyrles was rest. Then Meredith called. Meredith was in a state of high excitement. Bob recognized the now familiar telltale signs. The beaming, proud smile, the uncharacteristically rapid speech, the gesturing with his hands as soon as he entered his friend's office. And as Bob listened to Meredith's briefing, he, too, grew excited. A flurry of recent decryptions had added more flesh to the previous bare-bones description of rest. A cable from the center, sent in February 1945, had asked about rest's post-war activities. Advise forthwith the object of his trip to Chicago and whom he met there. In addition, an earlier cable, dated November 16, 1944, from the New York Residentura, informed the spymasters in Moscow that Rest is at Camp Number 2, the KGB's cover name for Los Alamos. He telephoned his sister and promised to come on leave for Christmas. Bob closely followed his friend's discoveries, and all the time his investigator's mind was making the evidentiary connections. When he left that afternoon, he took with him three new clues. Rest had been to Chicago after the war. He'd worked at Los Alamos. And he had a sister. He was optimistic that it wouldn't take him long to draw direct lines between each of these items and Rudolf Pyrles. As he'd expected, it didn't take Bob long to find the matches for which he'd been looking. Only he had been wrong about where they'd lead. 4 of the 15 British scientists on the original list, including both Pyrles and Fuchs, had worked at Los Alamos. But only one had been to Chicago in the winter of 1945, and only one had a sister who lived in America. These revelations shattered Bob's previous certainty, and now, when realigned, the scattered parts fit together seamlessly. He had been wrong, but at last he'd gotten it right. The mystery was solved. Klaus Fuchs was Rest. 26. When Bob had been taking law classes at night in Washington, one of his professors had shared a much-quoted wisdom. If you have the law on your side, hammer the law. If you have the facts, hammer the facts. If you have neither, hammer the table. But that advice, Bob wanted to moan, came up empty when he had both the facts and the law on his side, yet was restrained from using them. In this complex situation, all that pounding the table would get him would be bruised fists. That was the frustrating dilemma Bob confronted as he tried to plot a strategy for dealing with his unmasking of Klaus Fuchs. the strongest evidence he had that the scientist was a Soviet spy, codenamed Rest, was not only inadmissible in court, it couldn't even be whispered to anyone but the handful of people who had been cleared for Venona, as the Arlington Hall decryptions were now known among the initiates. All the confirming facts about Fuchs's communist background were black marks against his veracity and would jeopardize the scientist's security clearance, but they were not proof of any crime. And, not the least of the many factors making prosecution a murky possibility, Fuchs was no longer in America. He was a well-respected, naturalized British citizen. The likelihood of the British extraditing him to stand trial, and for what, the decrypted cables were capital that could never be tapped, hovered near non-existent. For all practical as well as legal purposes, Fuchs was beyond the reach of the decidedly foreshortened arm of American law. A victim of these circumstances, Bob, with a gloomy resignation, did the best he could. First, he opened a formal criminal investigation into Fuchs. Fuchase was the Bureau's code name. And for good measure he sent the industrious Ernie Van Loon to dig up all he could on Fuchs's sister, Crystal, and her husband, Robert Heinemann, who were living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Next, he wrote a carefully guarded memo, no mention of the Venona decryptions, only the thin charade of a reliable informant as his source, that nevertheless laid out a persuasively incriminating case against Fuchs. On his orders, the memo was hand-delivered to the representative of His Majesty's Secret Intelligence Service at the embassy in Washington, or the STOT, as this intelligence liaison officer was known in bureau speak. And then he waited impatiently for the British reaction, all the time harboring the unnerving knowledge that a Russian spy was well entrenched in a top-secret nuclear research facility. 3 maddening weeks passed before British intelligence replied to Bob's memo, and the official response was no less maddening. MI5 felt bound to advise the appropriate authorities in England that the continued employment of Fuchs in the atomic research station at Harwell, England, represented a grave risk to security, and that Fuchs should be consequently removed. Yet despite the lip service acknowledgment of grave risk, the British had so far taken no action. In fact, as they pondered how to proceed, their interim strategy was to make sure Fuchs had no reason to suspect he was under scrutiny. He was given a promotion, a salary increase, and, as a further mind-boggling reward, residency in one of the highly prized detached houses at Harwell. Bob exploded. While he had previously restrained himself, now all his irritation bubbled over. He had reached the state where he just might follow his professor's advice and give his desk one hell of a hammering. It seemed evident that there would be no reckoning. Fuchs could only be convicted by his own admission, and Bob was convinced there was no chance that a sly spy like Rest would ever betray himself. Yet Rest would be slowly nudged toward a confession, and the initial shove would come from a most unlikely quarter. There was a Russian spy in the British Embassy in Washington. Meredith had ferreted him out months ago, decrypting cables that revealed that a busy agent codenamed Homer had been regularly scooping up piles of classified message traffic that passed through the embassy and forwarding copies to the Soviets. Cable after lengthy cable sent to Moscow Center began with the heading, Materials from Homer. Bob had alerted the STOT officer that a fairly high-placed person in the British Embassy was a mole, but as best Bob could determine, MI5 was either unconvinced or infuriatingly complacent. Whenever he inquired, the response was a weary shrug followed by a terse, nothing new. It would be 2 more years before the British got around to unmasking Homer as Donald MacLean, and by then the British Foreign Service officer, one prescient step ahead of the authorities, would have hightailed it to Moscow. But in the autumn of 1949, Homer, still the diligent spy, had passed on to the spymasters in the Lubyanka the news that the Americans had alerted the British about Fuchs. Moscow swiftly let Sasha know that his agent could be placed under surveillance by MI5 at any moment. And the shaken handler couldn't help noting that this memo was written in the somewhat alarmist terms that were atypical of the center. Still, the KGB directorate, their eyes firmly fixed on the prize, refused to put rest in hibernation, as the jargon would have it. Fuchs, Sasha would write in an attempt to justify his boss's callous operational pragmatism, was giving us immensely valuable information and every month counted. Still, an increased level of caution was required, and so the news was shared with Fuchs. And it left him spooked. The interior world of any traitor is always in mayhem, always poised for one slowly festering nightmare to rise up suddenly and wreak havoc. The center's agitated warning pushed Fuchs closer to this breaking point. Informed that the Americans and the British were breathing down his neck, Fuchs began to look for a way out of the madness that had become his life. A letter Fuchs had received from his father became the opening move in his rapidly improvised game. And such was Fuchs's anarchic mood that even as he played along, he had no idea where it would end, or even how he hoped it would end. The letter had announced that the elder Fuchs was planning to take a chair in theology at the University of Leipzig, behind the Iron Curtain that had cut off East Germany. Dutifully, the son went to Henry Arnold, the Harwell chief security officer, and shared this development. He offered it up, accompanied by the sullen acknowledgment that it would undoubtedly affect his security clearance. It was bad business for the East Germans to have potential leverage on a scientist doing extremely sensitive research. Arnold, who had already been briefed on Bob's memo, told Fuchs he'd pass this on to the Harwell managers. They would decide what, if any, action to take, he deadpanned. But when Arnold informed the authorities, he couldn't help adding that it seemed as if Fuchs wanted to be stripped of his clearance. The scientist, he judged, was suffering through a full-blown psychological crisis. Yet Fuchs continued to spy, reconciling the warring sides of his life by what he'd call a controlled schizophrenia. With a brush pass down the block from the Spotted Horse pub in Putney, he gave Sasha a packet of documents that included a diagram of the next generation of hydrogen bomb. Accompanying the schematic of the super, as the weapon was nicknamed by the boastful scientists bringing it to life, was the official estimation of its destructive power. Blast, 100 square miles. Flash burn to horizon, or 10,000 square miles if detonated high up. Radioactive poison, produced by absorption of neutrons in suitable material, could be lethal over 100,000 square miles. The Russians read this report with a shudder. The new weapon could destroy a city the size of Moscow. In response, the Soviet Council of Ministers established a new thermonuclear research team to be based at a secret facility 400 miles east of Moscow called Arzamas 16. Its urgent mission? To manufacture a Russian hydrogen bomb. In England, meanwhile, MI5 had come around to deciding that it was time to apply pressure to Fuchs. Perhaps a little heat might thaw him from his seemingly frozen state, they reasoned. The job was assigned to William Skardon, an intelligence officer who had shrewdly coaxed confessions from Nazi collaborators during the war. Using the excuse Fuchs had conveniently provided, Skardon went to Harwell to question the scientist, ostensibly about the elder Fuchs's appointment to an academic post in East Germany. They sat down cordially in Fuchs's office on December 21, 1949, And the interrogation was the opening act in what would become a long-running play whose dialogue lurched back and forth between friendly concern and outright hostility. Yet all the while, Skardon was deliberately hurling his questions, one moment a lob, the next launched like a missile, at Fuchs's self-exposed vulnerability. This first session ambled along, Fuchs chattering happily about his time in America during the war. Then Skardon, as if the thought had just come to him, challenged, "Were you in touch with a Soviet official or a Soviet representative while you were in New York?" Fuchs did not answer, and Skardon did not press, but finally, "And did you pass on information to that person about your work?"
"I don't think so," Fuchs tried half-heartedly.
But in the next moment he recovered sufficiently to assume a defiant stance.
"I never did such a thing."
But Skardon's question hung in the air. Both men could feel its presence crowding the room as they broke for lunch. After lunch Skardon came out swinging, but Fuchs remained on his feet. Nevertheless, Skardon returned to London that evening convinced that the American suspicions were accurate. It would not be long before Fuchs, who had already adopted the fatalistic look of a man staring from his cell at the gallows, put his own head in the noose. Two more meetings occurred, Fuchs alternating his strident demands, "To tell me what the evidence is," with ponderous soliloquies about his contributions to science. Finally something inside Fuchs broke, and one morning he called Arnold, the Harwell security chief. He asked to see Skardon. On January 24, 1950, seated across from Skardon in his office at Harwell, Fuchs confessed. The words spilled out in a flood, as if he were glad to be at last sharing his secret life. There was no written statement at the time. Only later would he dictate his confession, an account of his descending deeper and deeper into the circles of hell that became his life. "At first I thought all I would do would be to inform the Russian authorities that work on the atomic bomb was going on. I concentrated mainly on the product of my own work, but in particular at Los Alamos I did what I consider the worst I have done, namely to give information about the principle of the plutonium bomb." Yet the session ended with its own sort of lunacy. Fuchs, with a valiant incomprehension, resisted conceding that he had done anything criminal. He hoped, he told Skardon, that his admission would not prevent his still attending the scheduled Anglo-American conference on the declassification of nuclear research as Britain's representative. And Skardon, a victim of his own wild logic, concluded the interview by simply walking off. MI5 officers were prohibited from making arrests. 3 long weeks would pass before the inspector for the State Commission for Atomic Energy, an old acquaintance of Fuchs's, called to suggest the scientist come to his office in London to clear up some of the details. When Fuchs got off the train at Paddington Station, teams of police converged around him.
"You're under arrest," a Scotland Yard inspector announced.
Burly men grabbed Fuchs's arms and led him off, the scientist staring into the distance, his eyes fixed in disbelief. Moscow rules. The term refers to the careful procedures used by spies throughout the Cold War when working in enemy territory, dictate that the handler always provide his Joe with a fallback date. If the agent, for any reason, the flu, a nagging spouse, an error of memory, fails to appear for the scheduled meet, he knows when the next rendezvous, and even the one after that, is scheduled. Just show up and all will be forgiven. In the nearly 2 months between Skardon's first conversation with Fuchs and the scientist's arrest, Sasha waited for rest on each of the designated fallback dates. He'd return to the Spotted Horse, near the Kew Gardens underground, order his beer, and try to find that consoling mixture of wishful thinking and grand purpose that allows a spy to sustain his covert life. Deep down I knew something had happened to Klaus Fuchs, he'd plaintively concede. But waiting there I hoped a miracle might happen. In 1 minute the door would open, and a very cool Klaus, just another respectable gentleman, would be smiling at me. On February 3, 1950, Sasha read the banner headline in the morning paper, "Spy Arrested for Atomic Treason." It was only then that he realized he would never see a very cool Klaus smiling at him again. While the British had seemed in no hurry to arrest Fuchs, they were suddenly in a great rush to conclude the legal proceedings. Such high-level treason was an embarrassment to His Majesty's government. And another reason for haste: the public didn't know about the facility at Harwell, or, for that sensitive matter, the independent British Atomic Weapons Project, and the authorities wanted to keep things that way. Fuchs came to trial on March 1st at the Old Bailey Courthouse, and the carefully orchestrated show was over in less than 90 minutes. The British Attorney General ruled that Fuchs could not be prosecuted for espionage, since, other than his rambling confession, there was no independent evidence to corroborate his treason. He was charged with 4 deliberately vague violations of the Official Secrets Acts. The only witness was Skardon. Fuchs did not testify. The scientist sat stoically in the defendant's cage. He assumed the judge would decree that he should be hanged by the neck until dead. Instead, he received the maximum possible sentence for the crime of conveying secrets to a wartime ally, a 14-year jail term. When his fate was announced, it was as if his imploding world suddenly came back into focus. "I felt what someone who is on death row must feel when he's told, 'You will not be executed, you're going to live,'" he'd reflect years later, still amazed to have escaped the hangman. As his agent began his jail sentence, Sasha planned his own escape. The center had instructed him to get out of London in a hurry, but he had convinced the spymasters that if he suddenly rushed to the airport, MI5 would realize his role in the case. "Why should we assist the opposition?" he argued. After all, in the course of his interrogation, Rest had not revealed his handler. "How old is he?" Skardon had asked. "He's neither young nor old. Let's say 35, Fuchs parried. "Is he tall?" "Well, yes, rather tall." "How well does he speak English?" "Very well. He's very fluent and has an excellent vocabulary."
"But does he have an accent?"
"Oh, yes, he does have an accent."
"A Russian accent? Or Slavic?"
"I wouldn't know. Possibly Slavic."
MI5 deduced that Rest's London case officer was an illegal, as non-diplomatic assets are known. Probably, they decided, a Czech or a Pole who had been living in London for some time, and most likely had become a naturalized citizen. Sasha continued as second secretary at the embassy for 2 months after the trial, making a point to live his cover. He laid flowers on Marx's grave in Highgate Cemetery and went to a screening of The Battleship Potemkin, the Young Socialists held at Oxford. When he was recalled to Moscow in April 1950, none of the MI5 watchers thought it was anything other than a routine diplomatic reposting. But the case was far from closed. For the FBI spy hunters, there remained one lingering mystery. During the course of his interrogation by Skardon, Fuchs had revealed he had an American contact to whom he had passed the stolen atomic secrets. He had offered few identifying details. Perhaps this was the cornered agent's stubborn refusal to share all he knew with the opposition,
Or, quite possibly, he'd never paid much attention. As best Fuchs could recall, the contact was around 40, about 5 feet 10 inches tall, with a broad build and round face. He knew him only as Raymond. When Hoover read the transcript of the interrogation, he quickly realized it was imperative to locate this Raymond. The courier, after all, might still be active. He still could be serving as a go-between for the spies in the field and their KGB handlers. The hunt would be, the director said, one of the most difficult and important quests ever undertaken by the FBI. Nevertheless, there would be no excuses for not finding him, he decreed. He chose Supervisor Lamphere to go to London to interview Fuchs and get the information that would lead the Bureau to Raymond. On the 13-hour flight, first stop Labrador, and then on across the Atlantic to London, the weather was calm, but a tempest raged in Bob's mind. He knew he could confront Fuchs with an advantage that Skardon never possessed, yet he wondered if it would be sufficient. He wistfully hoped that the information Meredith had uncovered, the catalogue of Venona secrets that could only be hinted at, never revealed, might succeed in prodding Fuchs's feeble memory, even perhaps loosen the restraints on his defenses. Yet never once in the course of his long, restless journey did he contemplate the other mysteries that would unravel after he pulled this thread. Part 3. Dominoes. 27. His plane landed under a gunmetal-gray London sky in the early morning, and Bob felt not just jet-lagged, but also in danger of coming completely unglued. From his throne on the fifth floor, the director had pointed his scepter straight at Bob. It was Supervisor Lamphere's responsibility to get Fuchs to put an actual name to Raymond. "The whole pressures of the world," Bob would grumble, his nerves stretched taut, "were on my shoulders to get that thing wrapped up, and as if that weren't burden enough, the weeks leading up to his departure had only added to the pile of woes weighing on his broad shoulders." There had been a whirlwind of preparations, an intense session locked away with Meredith to review one final time all the references to rest in the KGB cables, a visit to the State Department, where an officious junior staffer shuttled him about with a flattering deference as his diplomatic passport was issued, a mind-numbing lecture delivered by a Bureau lab man who had done some work with the AEC and who now attempted to pass on the rudimentary principles of constructing an atom bomb so Bob would be able to speak knowledgeably with Fuchs, brandishing an authoritative vocabulary that included such previously unknown phrases as implosion trigger, critical mass, and plutonium core, and not least, in his complex and ticklish world, a heart-to-heart with Sarah, suggesting that some time apart might do them both some good. And then, late on a Friday afternoon, just 36 hours before his scheduled departure, Bob received the phone call. It was from Troutmouth, as the rank-and-file agents called the Bureau's assistant director, Hugh Clegg. The nickname was a tribute to his habit of pursing his lips when he talked, a mannerism that, to hear the headquarters' catty gossip, left him always ready to bestow a sycophantic kiss on the director's broad posterior. But it wasn't just Clegg's dog-like obedience or stream of unctuous praise for Hoover that had gotten under Bob's and the other agent's skin. Clegg headed the dreaded inspection division, and therefore he sat in stern and constant judgment over supervisors like Bob, who were in the trenches doing, they felt with haughty pride, the actual work to catch the bad guys. Clegg wasn't an investigator. He investigated the investigators, and was, danger of dangers, an empowered critic who had Hoover's ear. And now Clegg was calling to ask Bob to send him the Fuchs file. Bob's first thought was malicious. This guy is so isolated from the field that he has no idea that the Fu case already ran to nearly 40 volumes. Perhaps, Bob tactfully suggested, rather than wade through the entire file, you'd prefer to read the summary brief? Clegg agreed that would be better, and at the same time somehow managed, Bob couldn't help feeling, to imply that it was his idea. It was only after Bob hung up the phone that a panicked question jumped up in his mind. Why the hell does Clegg want the Fuchs file? He ran to Al Belmont, the assistant director of domestic intelligence. Belmont gave it to him straight. He's going to London with you.
Jesus Christ, no, Bob erupted.
But it was the director's order, and hence could not be challenged. The most Belmont could do was offer a consoling summary of what had led to this last-minute decree. It seemed someone on Capitol Hill had whispered into Hoover's ear that a bureau official with genuine stature, perhaps Associate Director Clyde Tolson, should accompany Supervisor Lamphere to London. The snooty Brits, after all, were sticklers for protocol, and Lamphere was too far down on the bureau totem pole to impress them. The director, eager to keep the powers on the Hill in his corner, swiftly agreed. Only he wasn't prepared to send his number two man, and if the rumors had it right, his significant other, out of Washington for what might stretch into weeks on end. So he decided that Clegg could do the job. He was high enough in the pecking order to assuage the British sense of propriety. Also, his absence from the fifth floor for an indeterminate period was a loss that Hoover could endure. A still simmering Bob and a distant Clegg, unreconciled partners in a shotgun marriage, left Washington on Monday, taking the train to New York where they'd catch the flight to London. But no sooner had their train pulled out of Union Station than the first crisis occurred. Clegg broke his eyeglasses. Bob silently predicted this was just a small harbinger of what was in store now that a lifelong desk man had been sent out into the field. Finding his G-man voice and stare, Bob had to convince the conductor to hold the train in Baltimore while a rattled Clegg telephoned his wife with instructions to contact his ophthalmologist and get his prescription phoned in to the supervisor of the New York field office. Then Clegg called New York, and after making sure that it was understood he was on a special mission ordered by Director Hoover, arranged to have a new pair of glasses waiting for him at the airport when he checked in. Throughout the entire comical episode, Bob did his best to hold his tongue. "Anything other than the respect due his position," as Bob later recalled, "would have been a sure way to earn his displeasure." But Bob's discipline was put to further test on the interminable plane ride across the Atlantic. Clegg had absently inquired if Bob was Protestant. "Yes," Bob confessed, just making conversation. Yet once Clegg heard that, he launched into a tirade, one Protestant to another, about how the Bureau was suffering from an overabundance of Catholic influence in the hierarchy. This talk of a papist conspiracy at headquarters left Bob, who had a live-and-let-live attitude toward religion, as he did to most personal predilections, saddened and infuriated. And that wasn't all that was giving Bob second, or was it by now third, thoughts about what he'd gotten himself into. While Clegg's streak of prejudice was appalling, a more immediate concern to Bob was his lack of knowledge about espionage and counterintelligence operations. Clegg had the Fu case summary open on his lap for the entire flight, and every few minutes he'd turn to Bob demanding an explanation of one term or another. How was Clegg going to interrogate a long-running KGB spy like Fuchs if he didn't understand the fundamental rules of tradecraft by which a covert life is lived? Bob fumed. Clegg, to his credit, must have been asking himself the same question. Because after struggling through the case summary, the references to dead drops, brush passes, and handlers were as intimidating to him as was the nuclear physics that had been dished out to Bob, Clegg threw up his hands in surrender. He'd be present at the interviews, but, he announced, it would be Bob who handled the actual questioning of Fuchs. His job, as he presently defined it, would be to spread good cheer among his brother MI5 officers, to let them see that their American cousins appreciated the courtesy they were extending in letting the Bureau sit down with a British prisoner. Bob felt he'd won a small victory. But after Clegg had dozed off, and he sat wide awake in the darkness with his racing thoughts for company, Bob began to wonder if he'd been outsmarted. If there were any disasters, if Fuchs refused to speak, if Raymond could not be identified, there'd need to be a scapegoat. And the head of the inspection division, who'd had a ringside seat to the disaster, would place the blame squarely on Supervisor Lamphere. Adding to all Bob's mounting concerns, and making his mission even more consequential, was the somber fact that as he headed off to London, the Bureau had not been able to make significant progress in its search for Raymond. The director had made it clear that none of the Bureau's resources would be withheld. Neither cost nor manpower would be an issue. Yet so far, Bob conceded with as much stoicism as he could muster while staring defeat in the face, we're getting nowhere fast. Meredith was the ace hidden up Bob's sleeve, and in the frenzied weeks after Fuchs's arrest and circumspect confession, he had done his best to play the Venona card. The two friends sat together in Meredith's gloomy office, much like they'd done when they were first starting out on their hunt, only now, as they were gratified to acknowledge, their once quixotic collaboration had already bagged a Soviet agent in place at a British atomic center. With one scalp nailed to the wall, they had the confidence it would be short work to get the next. The big picture, as Bob hopefully called it, would come into focus. Meredith went back over the cables that had been sent between 1943 and 1945, and now, when he stitched them together, it became clear that Raymond's presence had been lurking in them all along. Only the KGB, guided by a very cautious tradecraft, had added one more concealing layer of word code to protect their cutout's identity. In the cables, Raymond had been rechristened as Gus. Or was it Goose? Meredith couldn't be sure of the precise translation, but there was no doubt that Raymond and Gus Goose were the same man. Bob was a rapt audience as Meredith trotted out example after example to prove his point. On February 9, 1944, a cable sent from the New York station noted, "A meeting took place between Goose and Rest." Another cable. When he checked out Rest's apartment, Goose was informed that Rest had left. And still another. Rest did not appear at the meeting, and Goose missed the next meeting. Bob quickly conceded that Meredith was correct. Goose and Raymond were one and the same. Yet, he impatiently challenged, where does this get us? One impenetrable code name had simply been replaced by another. One mystery had given way to a new one. And he might just as well have felt like shouting, "How does your deduction stop Hoover from breathing down my neck?" Locked in his doldrums, Bob returned the next day to backtracking over the transcript the British had sent of Skardon's interrogation of Fuchs. According to his annoyingly superficial confession, Fuchs had met Raymond 5 times in New York, and when the scientist had been working at Los Alamos, 2 times in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Bob rolled that about in his mind, looking for something to exploit. And little by little he began to think that maybe he had something. The New York meetings would have gone unnoticed. There were countless ways to hide in a big city. But by the same logic, it was a lot easier to attract attention in a southwest cowboy town like Santa Fe. A tweedy scientist with a pronounced German accent and a Soviet courier might stick out. The locals might remember these 2 strangers sitting in a restaurant or talking in a hotel lobby. It was, Bob had no doubt, a real long shot. But with all the nagging questions he continually received from the Bureau higher-ups, he decided he'd better try something. He instructed the New Mexico field office to dispatch agents to bus stations and airports across the state to see if anyone remembered an unusual visitor in the summer of 1945. In response, a flood of nearly 500 sighting reports piled up quickly on his desk. Unusual offered the locals room for a good deal of subjective leeway. Bob dove in, but in the end he found no needle hidden in this haystack. It was necessary, he realized, to refine his search, to give the agents in the field something more specific to sink their teeth into. But what? As he pondered this problem, he found his thoughts circling back to Meredith's discovery. What if, it suddenly struck him, Gus or Goose was not a code name? What if it were Raymond's real name? It would be another long shot, arguably even more improbable than his previous theory, but the fifth floor's constant badgering had brought him to this desperate state. He sent a flash alert to the New Mexico field offices, ordering a check on hotel registers during that same crucial summer for a guest named either Gus, Goose, or a close enough proximity of the two. He let it be known the inquiry involved the Foo case, but he once more cloaked his source under the veil of a reliable informant. Then he sat back and prayed. And lo and behold, his prayers were answered. A registration card for La Fonda Hotel in Santa Fe, filled out in June 1945, had been signed by a Gerson Gustorf. It was, he wanted to believe, too similar to be a coincidence. On his orders, agents began scouring the Southwest for Gustorf, the Soviet courier. The manhunt lasted 2 breathless weeks. And when the dogged agents finally located Gerson Gustorf, they found a 70-year-old proprietor of a Taos curio shop. The closest Gustorf had ever come to any contact with the KGB, the Bureau discovered after a vigorous interrogation, was that he once, maybe twice, he eventually conceded, had downed a shot of Russian vodka. And with that fiasco, we went back to square one, Bob acknowledged, in complete and utter defeat. 28. Yet leave it to Meredith to find something fresh to gnaw on. Despite Bob's petulant outburst at their last encounter, Meredith had not walked away from the hunt for Raymond. And returning to the cables, not surrendering until he could unlock the final recalcitrant block of code, Meredith had made a fresh discovery. Previously, he'd determined that Rest had a sister. But now, when he went back over this ground, his study isolated a fact that had been overlooked. The courier might very well have met with the sister. He shared the significant cables, all sent from the KGB's New York station in 1944 and 1945, with Bob. I sent Goose to Rest's sister. Goose will travel to Rest's sister on 26th September. On Arno's, Goose's cover name had been changed in one of the center's periodic bursts of routine housekeeping, Meredith explained. Last visit to Charles's sister, Rest, too, had a new name, it became known, and on and confirmingly on. Bob instantly grasped the significance of this new intelligence. Someone else had possibly seen Raymond. Fuchs's sketchy description of the courier might be amended with new eyewitness details. 2 agents from the Boston field office were sent to interview Crystal and Robert Heineman, Fuchs's sister and her husband, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. On Bob's orders, they were instructed to tread carefully. Crystal, who suffered from schizophrenia, had been in and out of mental hospitals. His concern, though, was more pragmatic than humane. He feared that if Fuchs's sister felt threatened, a potentially promising lead would be shut down. The agents were all tacked, and quickly they reaped the rewards. Both husband and wife had seen Raymond on two occasions, once when he came to meet Fuchs, and also when he knocked on their door without warning, trying to find the scientist. He'd introduced himself simply as Raymond, and they had no reason, they said, to press for a last name. But they could describe him. White male, age 40 to 45, 5 feet 8 inches tall, dark brown hair, broad build, and a round face. Bob now had no doubts they'd met with Raymond. The description tallied with the one Fuchs had shared. Only, he acknowledged with a renewed frustration, it could fit any one of several million Americans. At that low moment, Bob felt like putting down the interview summary and just walking away from his desk. But he read on. And there it was. As the agents were leaving, Robert Heinemann had accompanied them to the street and, away from his wife, grew more talkative. He revealed that in his own conversation with Raymond, the visitor had shared a little of his life story. He was a chemist, or maybe he was an engineer. Heinemann couldn't be certain. But Raymond had said he'd worked at a firm developing pesticides, as well as an aerosol container. His efforts, however, had not amounted to much, Raymond bitterly complained. A partner had cheated him out of his share of the business. Or maybe the culprit was simply a colleague, Heinemann had also suggested. His memory of the conversation was shaky. Armed with these new leads, Bob, working hand in hand with the dogged Van Loon, went back to work. The Bureau's files offered several hundred names of left-leaning chemists or engineers who could fit Raymond's general description. But Bob, with the wrath of the fifth floor growing hotter each day, wanted to believe he had found his man. Joseph Arnold Robbins was a heavy-set, Brooklyn-born chemical engineer. Heinemann's memory was better than he'd realized, Bob felt like telling him, with a bureau dossier crammed with left-wing affiliations. The finishing touch on the incriminating portrait, in Bob's mind at least, was that Robbins had graduated from City College in 1941, the breeding ground of Liberals' network. A photo of Robbins was delivered by special messenger to London, and the next day it was waved in front of Fuchs. "Was this Raymond?" he was asked. Fuchs studied it intently. "It might be the man," he agreed at last. "Are you sure?" the British pressed. Fuchs, as if back in his old life, once again a scientist weighing the validity of a new hypothesis, announced he had very fair certainty. That was good enough for Bob. Full-time surveillance was placed on Robbins. Perhaps, Bob hoped, they could catch him making a pickup from another of the spies in his network. And at the same time, the two tactful Boston agents had been dispatched once again to Cambridge. They were to persuade Robert Heinemann to travel to New York, where, after observing Robbins from a discreet distance, he could confirm that the target was Raymond. The trap was nearly ready to be sprung. Bob notified the fifth floor that an arrest was imminent. But just as he was poised to set things in motion, Van Loon came rushing in. The latest background check on Robbins had unearthed new intelligence. Robbins had been in New York throughout the entire summer of 1945. He had not left the East Coast for a single day, let alone the time it would have taken him to travel to New Mexico and meet with Fuchs in either June or September. And the Bureau was also certain he'd never been to Cambridge, never met the Heinemanns. Which meant, Bob understood with a fresh surge of desperation, that Robbins was not Raymond. And he had no other suspect to take his place. In 1945, about 75,000 license permits had been issued to chemical manufacturing firms in New York City. Just looking at the long list gave Bob a migraine, but he'd resigned himself to the task of going down it one company at a time in the dogged belief that Raymond had to have a connection to one of them. Yet as he was rolling up his sleeves, preparing to go through the mechanical process, Van Loon suggested a shortcut. He was a newcomer to counterintelligence, not an old hand like Bob. And so when he'd first come to headquarters, he realized he had to give himself an education. Conscientiously, he'd worked his way through the files documenting Soviet covert operations in America, and while doing so, he had read up on the Red Queen,